Lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Josephine Schlebert with us. She is the author of Is There Anybody Out There? A memoir of abuse and triumph. She's a survivor of a lifetime of child and domestic abuse. She's speaking out on normally taboo topics that will help others who suffer realize that they are not alone. Josephine currently lives in South Africa, runs a soup kitchen for her community, and cared for more than 100 refugee children from war-torn countries. She's now happily married and the mother of 5 children. And again, she's the author of Is There Anybody Out There? A Memoir of Abuse and Triumph. Josephine, hi. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, and it is an honor to be on your show tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we go back and we talk about abuse. Abuse in the continental United States may not be the same kind of abuse as in other countries. You know, we consider abuse, you know, somebody being beaten, etc. But from another country, the culture, those things that we don't take into consideration or we don't count into the mix here are things that usually are beyond fathomable. So let's start with you as a child. Where did it start with you?
I was 6 years old when my abuse started. My mother was a drug addict, and the man she met in her life was also a drug addict. And they were doing drug trafficking, and she was constantly drugged up. And it is was in that period of time that he started sexually abusing me. In the culture I grew up, that when you are abused victim, you are quickly cast out in your community when you do speak up, and the law constantly fails you. So abuse is it's more radical in South Africa than I believe in any other country, and that makes it so difficult to speak up. Is because when you see your law failing you and your community failing you, and that makes it so much harder to speak up when you find yourself in that situation of abuse.
And just
I was very young when my abuse started.
Yeah, let me hold you up. From what I'm hearing is that, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but in South Africa, abuse was something that was acceptable. And when I say acceptable, if you couldn't talk about it, if you couldn't let anybody know, obviously within that culture itself, then it was something that was acceptable. Am I off base here?
You're so right. It is very true what you are saying, and that's also what makes it so hard, because no one believes you. It is acceptable and it's right in everyone's eyes, and you just have to keep quiet and let the thing just take its course. You're right when you say it is very acceptable in our country when that do happen, and that is the sad thing about it. That's why so many children commit suicide in a country, because it is seen as an acceptable thing.
Now, when we talk about abuse, we're talking about physical abuse, sexual abuse. We're talking about all of it from every stage.
Yes, we do talk about every stage of abuse, whether it's physical, sexually, or in any other form. We talk. It's classified as the same thing. And it doesn't get dealt with.
Okay. Now, by the way, you were also forced to deal drugs too. So it got way beyond your ability to cope and to handle things. How did you step out of it? You come from a society, again, a culture, I'm going to use the word again, that allows the drug dealing, they allow the abuse, etc. How does a child step out of that? How does a child protect themselves within that kind of a world?
You know, it is very difficult to actually step out of it, especially if you've been forced into that situation by a parent. You know, I believe that any child should enjoy school life, especially if it's their first year of schooling, and that was just not possible with me. I could not enjoy my first year of schooling. I was forced to sell drugs to big gangsters and thieves and murderers and pimps. It was only when I reached the age of 19 that I decided that this is now the time that I had to step out. I need to make a life for myself. I need to find something for decent to do. And I had to stand up. I had to stand up against my mother, and I had to stand up against my stepfather, and I had to step out quickly.
No, what I'm hearing also, before age 19, before you decided to step up and step out, that you overhead was this, there had to be a fear of if you stepped out of line, somebody would kill you. And what a way to grow up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you stand up against these gangsters, selling them drugs. You don't know who can pull out a gun and rob you and just kill you. I mean, I have seen many instances where gangsters would come into our house and I had to hide the drugs from the gangsters and actually protect my mother and her boyfriend from these gangsters. It's very difficult in that position when you sell drugs to these gangsters to step up, because you do not know what's going to happen, you know.
Okay, so you decided that enough was enough. How did you break that cycle? Standing up to your mom and dad, that must not have been the easiest thing for anybody to do.
No one stands up against my mother and gets away with it. So, yeah, it was quite difficult to stand up against her, to walk out of it. She was physically abusing me. So I had to have a lot of courage to do that. But I did it. I did it. I took my children and I went to a place that shelter for women, destitute women. So I went to a place where I felt secure, where she could not come and control me or take me back.
Now, by the way, where did the children come from? And I don't mean specifically a name, but how many children did you have at the time at 19 when you broke away?
When I was 16 years old, my stepfather was released from prison after spending 2 years in prison. He raped me, and I fell pregnant, and I had to leave school at that time. When I turned 19, he forced himself again on me, and I fell pregnant again with my second child. So both my eldest children are from the perpetrator who sexually abused me from 6 years old.
There's no law against that?
You know, no one knew. I couldn't. I only told my mother when I was about 25 years old. I told my mother the real story. I told her who the children's father is and how it started, and from what age he started abusing me. So there was no one knew I was carrying this secret for many years on my shoulders. So there wasn't a thing that he could go to jail for that, because no one knew about it until I broke my silence to my mother when I was 25 years old.
Now, by the way, when you met your husband, what was it like getting to being with someone who didn't abuse you? And when I say that, it's got to be very hard to come out of a habit, a pattern of being abused, and then to find somebody who doesn't do that, that had to take some getting used to.
It was difficult to adjust to. It was difficult because all the men that I knew it was in my life from my stepfather was abusive. And now you meet a man and he treats you totally the opposite and you're wondering, is this normal or is it abnormal? Who is normal in this relationship? Because this is not how normal people behave. Normal people to me was people that abuse you. And here you meet someone that do not do it and you can't, it took me years to adjust to this kind of relationship. And I can only honestly say to you, it's only about 3 years that I actually adjusted to it and accepted it. This is how normal people live.
Mm. Now, by the way, but when the soup kitchen, when did you start that?
I started it about almost 3 years ago when we moved from the Eastern Cape, from the Western Cape to the Eastern Cape. And I started the soup kitchen amongst the community here. Where I moved to the rural areas, it's very poor and there's very little to eat. And one day I was sitting outside and I heard in my mind, I believe it was God telling me to open a soup kitchen and to feed the people, which was very difficult for me to do because at that time my husband also lost his job and he was looking for a job at that time. And I thought to myself, how can I feed people when I myself need feeding at this time? And what I did was every night I would take from my food before I dish up for my children and I would look for someone on the street and give him some food. And that's how the soup kitchen came about.
Now, by the way, the kids from the different countries that you took care of, the over 100 refugee children from the war-torn countries, how did they know to come to you? Did people just start to know that when they came in to direct them to Josephine?
Well, when the place that we were looking after the kids was in a church ministry, it sheltered a lot of people. That's the place that I went to when I broke away from my family, from my mother and them. I went to that place, and then I started working in this place. And that's how I was put in charge of a section of children where we would cater for these refugee children that comes from these war-torn countries. And that's where, and they would come in by the truckloads. They would come in by the truckloads. And that was my job for more than 12 years, was taking care of these children. Educate them, put them through school, teach them English or Afrikaans. So that was my job and my husband's job to do.
Now, what is life like there now? And not necessarily for you, because you found your calling and you found that person that you could spend your life with and you have your children and you've helped so many people. But other people in South Africa, is the abuse still going on? Are the drugs still going on? Is it beginning to change or has nothing changed?
Nothing has changed. It's actually going from bad to worse. I mean, every second door, there's a child that's being molested. And it's so sad because the age range for children being abused there is from 6 months old. That's how bad it's gone. The drug trafficking is so spreading rapidly in our country. You actually make this type of drug in your house. Your cleaning detergents, you can take and make drugs from it. So it has gone from bad to worse, and so many people, children are dying, and so many children are being abused and being raped and murdered by their own fathers or stepfathers because of this drug. And it looks like the law can't handle it.
Let me ask you this. Is there anything that anybody from the outside can do to help the situation? Is there anything that anybody in the U.S., in any, you know, in France, anywhere, is there anywhere anything that anybody else can do from England, someplace?
You know, if it's possible, if anyone can help us, it will be very great to get some outside help. And fortunately in our country is so closed up to other people helping them. in that department because they will feel like failures. So if that can possibly happen, that outside help can reach into our country, it will be great. But for now, I just see our country just going from bad to worse, and the children are suffering under it. We call ourselves a rainbow nation, but our children are suffering under this drug abuse, under this sexual abuse.
Now, by the way, do you have a website that we can find you at? We're starting to run out of time now.
Well, I'm busy setting up a website. So I do not have a website, but I do have an email address that listeners can email me to if they feel they want to.
Well, by the way, how do we order the book?
You get it on the website by Author House or on any website, Barnes & Noble, Google Edition, Sony Readers, and etc. We'll get it on all those websites.
Wonderful. Okay, and your email address very quickly.
As readmystory@rocketmail.com.
Okay, readmystory@rocketmail.com. Hey, Josephine, thank you so much for joining us. I really believe if you get that word out, that book gets sold, more and more people will know. And one way or the other, it'll get cleaned up. Maybe not tomorrow, but someday.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night. Bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Andrew Lady's with us. He is the author of Rebel Bookseller, Why Indie Businesses Represent Everything, Everything You Want to Fight For, From Freedom of Speech to Buying Local to Building Communities. And let's say, Andy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You co-founded Children's Bookstore, Children's Book Fair Company, Children's Museum Store, and PovertyFighters.com. Andy, I guess really what's going on is we're getting to lose that community of booksellers that were out there, and we've gone to the e-book and the book itself, and all of those things that we need to be able to stabilize who we are seems to be drifting away. Where was it that you decided to write the book, take a stand, and let people know what the world of books are about?
Well, I got into bookselling in 1979. I was hired at a B. Dalton bookseller in Chicago, and so I've been in the business now for over 30 years, and I've seen some real decentralization and concentrations and ebbs and flows. The industry book distribution, book publishing has changed repeatedly over that period. And so one of the things that I've learned is that if you look at the situation right now, you're just seeing a very small snapshot. And at this moment, it does appear that there's this huge shift happening. But in fact, there are still tens of millions of people who love to go into physical bookstores. They love to buy real books. And, you know, Amazon controls about a quarter of the market right now. And sure, there's a reason they don't control 80% of the market. It's because lots of people still like to go to real world bookstores. And so companies like big companies like Borders may go out of business, but that doesn't mean there aren't lots and lots of people who would like to shop for books. And independent bookstores are an extremely flexible model. People can develop independent bookstores to respond to the real opportunities that are out there market by market.
Andy, was it financial? Was it dollars that drove the e-book to the popularity that it is because it was less expensive to do? You know, if you look back a few years ago, you had 300,000-400,000 brand new authors every year on the market. Now it's gone way over millions, and they're going to the e-book. Is there anything to do with someone's financial ability to produce a book? They found it easier to do there, and they're not thinking of the public at large.
Well, you know, there are so many people writing in this country. There's some terrific writing going on, and we had this bottleneck. The way that the big publishers kind of got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the big booksellers got bigger and bigger, and they're all looking for a blockbuster. That's the way that they were buying and selling books. And meanwhile, so many people were writing more and more because of email, because of they could write a blog, and they got better at writing. You know, you practice a lot, you begin to think, gee, I could write a book. And then it turns out these big companies, they don't want to publish a book, but there's all these wonderful new tools available where you can produce your own book and do it print on demand. So it is absolutely true that the e-book is the cheapest way for people to publish their own book, but I can tell you, everybody who publishes an e-book has a hankering inside them to make it into a real book. And that's why you have these print-on-demand mechanisms that have risen at the same time as the e-book, where people can produce a paper book one-off. And independent booksellers are putting these machines into their stores now. There's 50 of them around the country, and it's increasing. The Espresso book machine, which enables people to set up their books as print-on-demand books and have them available for people to get a physical copy in a bookstore. So you're absolutely right. The change in the technology has really liberated people to publish their own books and not have to wait for a big company to put their stamp of approval on. It's wonderful.
I remember that I can tell you exactly when it happened. It was right about the time that George Bush was going to get the second election, and there was an author who created a book, and it was all about a conspiracy theory where Bush was going to blow the planet up and so on and so forth. And the timing, he had to be just so. He had to do it before the election, and somehow there was a delay and a delay and a delay, and he ended up with probably $150,000 worth of books in his garage, and it stayed there, and it's probably there today. And that, I think, scares a lot of people, that they think the minute that they do something like that, they can't afford to go out and do everything that you do to become, you know, to produce a book. That's not necessarily so. But on the other side of it, you better know what you're doing or you can get hurt with it.
Well, technology has there are periods when technology is used by large companies. If they're the only ones that can afford, you know, the big machines, the gigantic servers. But technology can also free individuals up to take control of their lives. And that's what's happening now. And when we opened our first bookstore, the children's bookstore in Chicago in 1985, we were the first buyers of a low-end inventory control program for bookstores called Booklog. We were criticized by other independent booksellers in Chicago that we were going to let a computer tell us what to buy. We were just using it as our cash register. It was a computerized cash register that tracked what books sold. Now, it's hard to believe that such a thing was very controversial among independent booksellers in the mid-'80s, but it was. And we benefited from computerizing our independent bookstore. And so although it was controversial at the time, we were able to take that increasing the fact that the cost of technology was dropping made it accessible to us, a small business. And that's what's happening with the Internet. That's what's happening with these new kinds of self-publishing technologies. I am in the process of opening a one-month bookstore in Holyoke, Massachusetts that we're going to open in April in conjunction with an art show. We're going to be selling self-published books from community residents. We'll be selling zines that people are producing on copy machines. There's no reason that independent bookstores can't do a really good job of helping people who are self-publishing to promote their books to their neighbors, among the most logical buyers. And this gives us a great opportunity, which the large companies aren't even going to think about doing this stuff.
By the way, Andy, I've been around authors for years and years and years and years, and I am one myself. And the key here, what I think is what you're saying is absolutely spot on, and I'm on the exact same side of the table that you are. Because when it really comes down to it, when push comes to shove, it's that physical book that you could put in your hand, put up on the shelf, put it on the coffee table, and it's yours. It's got a different feel than an e-book, even though the e-book says the same thing.
Well, the e-book is a very valuable addition to the arsenal of for people communicating with one another. It doesn't replace the physical book, but it's just wonderful. And so I think that some people think that the rise of e-books means the death of physical books, but what it really means is that people who are running companies, people who are in business with a business model that is getting outdated, had better change their business model, had better invent a new business model, and that is absolutely happening all over this country. People are adapting.
You know, there's a couple of things as you're speaking that I'm thinking about here. One is it's to stay where we were as a culture. There is that the mom and pop movement is kind of gone, and most people who don't even know that even existed didn't get to touch it. When you walked into a place and they knew who you were and they knew who your family was and what the name of your dog was, and when you talk about bookstores build communities, I totally buy into that. And buying local is a wonderful movement because it creates a collaboration, a camaraderie with those people in the community that may not have had that something in common to be able to touch each other with.
Well, we're seeing it happen all over the country. Independent bookstores are heading into a renaissance. There are several hundred independent bookstores that have opened around the country in the last few years. And it is underreported in the media, but it's really quite different than what was happening 15 or 20 years ago when independent bookstore numbers were dropping. Independent bookstore numbers are rising, and it's because the neighbors really do respond when a local bookstore shows up and it's open into the evening and there's performances and there's open mic nights. And you're right, the owner is there and they're committed to making sure that people have a chance to express themselves and to share ideas about reading that are appropriate to their local community. And you see that it's similar to the CSA agriculture movement, the community-supported agriculture movement. It's like craft beer. There are all kinds of ways in which people are really building their own communities themselves, and somebody steps forward and says, I'm going to run the bookstore here. And everyone says, thank goodness, someone's going to open a new bookstore. So it's a very rewarding experience to open an independent bookstore, and this is a moment when a lot of people will thank you if you decide you're going to do it.
No, but did the indie books have a franchise?
Well, I think that they have an opportunity. Because you have these big corporations kind of backing off from selling books, so that gives you a way to step in. Now, there isn't a franchise company that you can buy into, but you can become a member of the American Booksellers Association and get all kinds of educational tools. You can attend conferences. And independent booksellers own their companies separately from one another, but they do tend to be collaborative at an industry level. They tend to share information. They tend to welcome newcomers in, and so I wouldn't say there's not a franchise in the sense that you franchise a store, but you can become part of an informal network or a trade association.
See, here's what I was looking at based on what you do and the way that you do it. If you created this program whereby if somebody wanted to do it, you could reach out, hold them by the hand or her by the hand, and take them through step by step by step until they got it done. I think one of the biggest fears of opening a bookstore is somebody may just not know how to do it, and they're frightened to death of the unknown. But if they've got somebody looking over their shoulder through a different set of eyes to see the things that they don't see and to guide them, that's a whole different story.
I think that there are opportunities to launch franchise companies, but I don't know of one that exists right now. There used to be the Little Professor Company, which was franchised, and the Logos Bookstore Association had some similarities to a franchise, though it was really more of a national marketing and education entity. So, no, it's interesting. What you're saying is you're pointing out that, in fact, franchising is not a dominant model in the bookstore sector. We tend to have either company-owned chains or nonprofits. For instance, I run a store inside of a museum right now, Universities tend to have bookstores. The co-op model is a very interesting bookstore where the community owns shares in a company, in a bookstore. Or the producer co-op, that's the way that Food for Thought Books at Amherst, Massachusetts is. So there are a lot of different business models, but the franchise doesn't seem to be one that has really been enormously successful in the book sphere.
Yeah, even a franchise was it. Yeah, but even a franchise was the wrong word to use. That what I was looking for was some nucleus, some place where somebody could go and they fell in love with the idea, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Well, there again, the American Booksellers Association. It's at www.bookweb.org. You join them as a prospective member, and I think it costs $125, maybe I'm not sure about the price, to become a prospective member, and then you start going to schools. And you can go to workshops and to seminars, and then there's online services as well. You can actually educate yourself to a certain degree. There is no certification to be a bookseller, and that is a very interesting thing because people like me who've been in the field for decades feel that we are professionals. We have a lot of specific technical knowledge, both bibliographic. We know a lot about books. We know a lot about business, and we know a lot about the industry. You can't go to school to become a bookseller, and that is something that is really fascinating because you can study to be a librarian. You can get certified to do all kinds of different things in this society, not to be a bookstore. There is no certification. There's no formal education. You can go to business school, but the only way to really learn about the bookstore business inside out is to work in a bookstore, and you may or may not be able to find a job. So a lot of people have to sort of back into bookselling somehow or other. It's interesting. It's a disorganized field.
Yeah, it's well, as you say, it's an OJT, on-the-job training. You're right. You can't go to school
for it.
That's
right. I'm sure that there are many fields like that, but it is kind of curious because it's a very important field. People take books seriously. Big conversations in this country happen when a new book gets published. The authors are understood to be significant speakers in our culture, and so it is strange that bookselling is so much just a hardcore business. We talk about it in terms of the share price of the big book-selling companies. Everyone's interested in how much Amazon stock is going for right now. Whereas on the other side, we train librarians, and they have to get a master's degree, and then we pay for libraries with tax money. But book-selling is free. We have free speech in this country. The First Amendment tends to keep the government out. And so that's one of the things that's marvelous about bookstores is that if you open a bookstore, you become kind of like a local media outlet. You become, or like as if you'd launched a local newspaper, you become a voice. You become someone who is helping to propagate ideas in your community. And because of that role in distributing ideas, I believe that's why it's not particularly regulated. That's why it's not particularly organized. Just like you could open a newspaper, a small newspaper in your town without much capital, you can open a bookstore too.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. Radio Susie just said, Dutton's, I looked over at her. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. We were in the Hollywood area, and Dutton's bookstore closed. And I remember the day that they closed, we got there with a lot of other people that we knew, and the place was mobbed. And there were people with microphones. There was television there, and people were telling stories about, the books they've got there, the people that they met there, and the social networking that went on there. And I'll never forget that. It was almost like someone had passed away.
Yes. And I believe that the Dutton story, which is it's often true that when an independent bookstore closes, there are very specific reasons why that particular bookstore closed. And I think that the Dutton story had to do with the real estate values shifting in a neighborhood and a building having been sold. And this is the thing, is that independent bookstores may have a lifespan. It may be that a bookstore is founded by somebody and that person does it really energetically, and decades go by, and the person gets older, and the kids don't want to take it over, and meanwhile, the neighborhood has improved, the rents are going up. Bookstores close, and it's very natural for bookstores to close. But what I like to tell people is that our concern is not about the death rate. Our concern is about the birth rate. We need to have people opening bookstores at least the same rate as they close, and they will close. But and best would be if there are more people opening bookstores than are closing. So, of course, a bookstore like Dutton's, when it closes, it should get attention in the media. Those facts that you just brought forward about the importance of bookstores and a specific bookstore in people's life, that's so profound. And at the same time, there are people opening bookstores in Los Angeles. I'm going to be in Los Angeles next month, September 11th. I'll be doing a panel at Skylight Books, which is a bookstore that used to be called Chatterton's. It's been reincarnated when its founder had to leave, and they got someone to take it over, and they changed its name to Skylight. And other people on the panel will be David Kippen, who founded Libros Schmibros in Los Angeles last year. This is the thing, is that people are founding bookstores in Los Angeles, even though Dutton's closed in Los Angeles.
Oh, no question. I got it. By the way, keep up the good work. We're running out of time now. Andy, do you have a website we can find you at?
Well, you can go to rebelbookseller.com. If you are looking for a good independent bookstore in your area, you can go to indiebound.org, and you type rebelbookseller.com into the search box, and then it'll give you the opportunity to find a bookstore in your area. You type your zip code in to buy Rebel Bookseller at. So you don't even have to buy Rebel Bookseller from the chains or from Amazon. You can go to a local bookstore, or you can buy it through IndieBound from a local bookstore.
Wonderful. Hey, Andy, ladies, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. Keep it up. Go get them.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Take care. Good night. How's you know, honey? You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone. You feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Carrier with us, or is Carrier with us? He is the author of Innovation for the 21st Century, Harnessing the Power of Intellectual Property and Antitrust Law. He's a professor at law at Rutgers University School of Law in Camden. He has published and has spoken widely on the antitrust and intellectual property laws and is one of the leading authorities in the country on the intersection of these laws. And let's say, Mike, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Intellectual property, there's so many people who do not understand what that means. You start something, you start a business, and that context of what it is that causes you to move and maneuver, that's your intellectual property. And then people do not realize that it's more than just writing. It's a unit of ownership. And most people don't get that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Intellectual property is incredibly important, and it's becoming even more important with each passing day. You look at our economy, and you look at how important innovation is. Patents are things like patentable inventions, things like copyrighted works. And so I think we're long past the time of the steel mills and the oil refineries and all that. We have some of that, but so much of our currency and our economy today is based on intellectual property.
Now, by the way, intellectual property is not just words. Where does it branch out to? What are we talking about if the average person? Go ahead.
Yes, sure. So there are several branches of intellectual property. Most often it is affiliated with patents and copyrights. So a patent is given by the government, the U.S. Patent Office, if you have an invention that no one else has created. And the government will give you a 20-year period in which you can exclude all others in order to encourage invention. Also, there are copyrights. So copyrights apply to things like words on a page, so books or poems. It applies to music and sound recordings and things like that. And that copyright could last for an even longer period of time, your life plus 70 years. And then there are other types of intellectual property that don't get as much attention. I'll just mention two really briefly. One is a trademark, and that is how a brand is known in the marketplace. So, for example, you can't sell soda and copy the Coca-Cola trademark because then you would be trying to confuse consumers, and that's not right. And then finally, there's trade secrecy, and that prevents competitors from, in a sense, spying on you to try to figure out what you're doing and to copy it. And so intellectual property is this broad umbrella term, and those are the main types of intellectual property that are covered when you hear that term being used.
Mike, when you're dealing with intellectual property, do most, even businesses, even most sophisticated businesses, realize the depth of this particular issue? Because it is deep, and most people really don't get it, do they?
Most people don't, and it's funny because you really see this changing year to year. So, for example, universities a couple of decades ago had very little to do with patents. And now you look at some of the leading universities, and they have what are called tech transfer offices that are in charge of making money, sometimes millions of dollars, from patents. And you have other companies that are doing similar types of things, trying to patent things that they couldn't patent before. But it really gets very complicated, and that's why it's really worth some attention, given how complex it is.
Oh, by the way, software, I think, is a great example of that. There are certain softwares, they have a value proposition. It's different than anything else out there. They get it copywritten, and they tie it down from there. But the point of contention is that if they don't protect it, and that's what we're talking about here is protection, if they don't protect it, they're going to lose it to someone else.
Yeah, so software is a funny story because software can be protected by patents. It can also be protected by copyrights. And you're right, there, if you don't protect it, there is that concern that someone's going to take it away from you. But it's funny because there was actually innovation in software even before you had all these patents and copyrights being filed over the last couple of decades. And so some folks actually think there's been too much patenting, too much copywriting here, because what happens with innovation sometimes is that you build on what has come before. And so if the first creator, someone first in line, is able to copyright their software, then others down the line won't be able to build on it. So there's actually a downside from maybe even having too much intellectual property.
Okay, so effectively you're talking about the now, and then you're talking about aftermarket issues also. So if somebody actually is sitting down, this is why we need an attorney. My hat's off.
But
when you sit down and you're ready to do something like that, you have to look, and this is what I'm listening to what you're saying. This is what I'm getting out of it, that you have to look behind you. You have to look at what's going on now, and you have to forecast when you're going to deal with intellectual property, copyright laws, etc. So you really have to look at it from every angle once you touch on this.
You really do. You have to look at what has come before you. Is it protected by patent or copyright? You have to look at what makes most sense for you now. And so, for example, one choice that small businesses, individuals, even large companies make is whether or not they should get a patent or get a trade secret. So sometimes it makes sense just to keep your business process a secret. And so you'll keep it as a trade secret. You won't apply for a patent, because if you apply for a patent, then you have to tell the world what your new invention is. And, of course, going down the road into the future, you have to think about what will be best for you from a business standpoint, what will give you the most value proposition. And oftentimes that's a complicated issue, and you really have to think hard about it.
You know, innovation is the important word, and I really believe that the one thing that the United States has that can never be taken away from us, we may not be as competitive in a global marketplace as we were at one time or within our own world, but what we really had was innovation. you know, innovation for the 21st century, but we had innovation. One of the things that we had here, we had people with minds that could look ahead, and we were innovative. That in and of itself was one of the most powerful tools that we had to work with. Now, you talk about the pharmaceutical industry and the innovation that can get stifled there if somebody's got a couple of bucks to stop somebody from producing another product.
I do, and I do think that innovation is absolutely crucial. It's important now when our economy is not as strong as it's been in the past. It's important even when our economy is strong. And the reason is that innovation makes all of our lives better. Innovation leads to greater increases in economic growth than anything else, things like lowering price or anything else. And so the question is, and the reason I wrote this book, is that I was really astonished. So I teach intellectual property law like we've been talking about. I also teach antitrust law, which aims for a competitive marketplace. And I thought that those laws were actually supposed to help innovation. And my surprise, as I've been teaching through the years, is that these laws actually sometimes go the direct opposite way of the way they should be going. And so I wrote this book just to focus on innovation and to look at 10 different places where the laws go in the wrong way to try to fix it so we could get more innovation. And you're right, the pharmaceutical industry is one of those where there's some activity that goes on that does promote innovation, but there's a lot of other stuff that actually stifles innovation and could affect price as well. And so that's one of the things that I focus on.
Well, you got a double-edged sword here with innovation. As you were talking, I'm a pharmaceutical company. There's another pharmaceutical company in the market. I pay them billions of dollars not to make their product, which allows me to skyrocket my price, and it costs everybody more money. I'm making money, but what was I to do that? Somewhere in the company, somebody was showing innovation to get the idea to buy somebody off. So it's a very interesting word that we use here, and it's how you use it. We are in a world that we're supposed to be, the big S word. We're supposed to be in a country that is run by the rule of law, but the rule of law gets twisted. And I think what we're dealing with here, and I'm not an attorney, but are we dealing with the interpretation of the law to be able to maneuver it in the way that will get you what you want?
Yeah, you know, part of that I couldn't have said better myself, in that the first point is that innovation really is such an open-ended term that everyone argues that they're in favor of innovation. Who's going to say they're against innovation? So,
sure.
So in one sense, I mean, we're all in favor of innovation. But then the question is, what do we do with that? And so there are some things we can do in terms of focusing on new products that come to the marketplace. And you're right, it is an innovation to buy off generics, but that's not the innovation I'm talking about. Rather,
sure.
I'm thinking of the products that come to the marketplace for consumers. And the point about the rule of law being twisted is really what I've begun to think about recently in terms of why this is going on. So basically what happens is you have a large brand name pharmaceutical company. They pay, for example, hundreds of millions of dollars to a generic company not to enter the market. The generic company might think that the brand firm's patent is no good. It's a really narrow patent. Maybe the brand company lied to the patent office. So the patent's really no good. The generic should be able to come to the market and should introduce lower prices for consumers. But the brand company pays off the generic, and by time you get into all the intricacies of patent law, antitrust law, there's something Congress passed called the Hatch-Waxman Act, there's Food and Drug Administration law. It's just so complicated that at the end of the day, courts just say, you know, it's too complicated, the settlement looks fine to me. And from my perspective, it's just complication that is driving the outcome here.
Well, and by the way, and you're right, complication driving the outcome, and not to be political, but it's back to Nancy Pelosi. You know, well, just pass it and we'll find out what it is after it's done. And I think that's really what you're dealing with a lot of these issues. You're right, it is so complicated that nobody wants to bother with it. And it gets so convoluted that you end up with people that just back off and they bury their head in the sand, and that's the end of it, and it goes nowhere. So I don't necessarily know if there's anything that we can do about this. There's not really any oversight committees that'll do anything, because the pharmaceutical companies in and of themselves are their own oversight committees. It's not our Food and Drug Administration. The testing, et cetera, comes from the pharmaceutical companies. So it's kind of an interesting catch-22 that we're in.
It really is. And I get my hopes up every year. There's been legislation in Congress for each of the past several years that is designed to deal with this issue. So basically, the courts are looking at these agreements and saying, good, these agreements are fine, we have no problem with them. And so there's been legislation that would say, well, actually, courts, you should look at these more skeptically, and you should say that these are presumptively illegal. And so I think that's pretty good legislation, and it's been a bit frustrating that it's gotten far along. Each of the past few years, I thought it was going to be part of health care reform when it was passed in the House of Congress, but at the very last minute it was pulled out for a lot of the reasons you're talking about, that the lobbying is pretty strong. But this is an issue that I think Congress really can do something about, and one thing to do is maybe just to call Congress and say, let's do something about these agreements, and perhaps you can show courts that we should be a little more skeptical of them.
Mike, who's your target audience with this? When I say target audience, the book specifically, the average person is not going to be able to pick this book up and understand it in total, whereby there's that motivation for that call to action to do something. And it's the motivation part that gets them stimulated to get to that place. So who's your target market with this? What was specifically, what was the purpose of the book?
So the purpose was to raise awareness of these legal issues that affect innovation. And so one target that could deal with it is just congressional staffers and congresspeople themselves in looking at things that they could do to fix the law to get more innovation. And, you know, I think there are a lot of members of the public out there that care about these issues, that care about things like drug prices, like innovations. And so maybe I might have a little too much faith, but I think there are a lot of folks out there who would be interested in issues like this, who could even pick up the phone and call Congress and say, you know, our drug prices are out of control. Let's do something about it. And so I'm trying to hit those people as well.
Okay, and now let me ask you this. The average person, and just to talk to the congressman doesn't seem, the congresspersons, doesn't really seem to do the job anymore. How do we affect anything? It seems as though it should be a trickle-up effect, but it's been a trickle-down effect. I think a lot of what we're seeing today is that people are forgetting who's working for who. So how does the average person get in there and make a dent?
So what can an individual do that is faced with this decision between a generic and a brand name product? One thing to do is just to go to the doctor, and when you get prescribed a drug, just ask, can I get the generic instead? And if the answer is no, then ask why. Because a lot of the times, I think doctors are given this information that you have to take the brand and you can't consider the generic. And in a rare case, that might be the case. But I think a lot of the times, the generic can do the job just as well. So just as simple as going to the doctor and asking for a generic might be one simple thing to do to try to raise awareness of the issue.
Interesting. We're starting to run out of time, but interestingly enough, you know, I've seen a lot of people doing lately. They've been going to Canada for their pharmaceuticals. The prices are maybe one-tenth of what people will spend at the local drugstores. And what's gone on is that the pharmaceutical industry, using, quote-unquote, some of this innovation, are driving people away from the industry in and of itself and having them look in alternatives which are not even in the country anymore.
Yeah, and there are lots of concerns with that. And once you drive people out of the United States, there are just questions in terms of quality and safety. And so I certainly do not think that's a good development.
Oh, no question. But where I was at with that, Mike, it's happening. That's what the concern is. Anyways, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. So my Rutgers website is my main one. You can just Google Michael Carrier, and the first entry that pops up is my Rutgers website. And I have a quick paragraph on my bio, and then I have a whole bunch of links to the book on Amazon in terms of a hardcover, a paperback, a Kindle version. So basically, whatever version you want, it's there, and just a direct link that'll take you to the book.
Wonderful. Hey, Mike Carrier, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms, and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk, and Dresser After Dark. You can tell that's not taped. Anyways, the book is Clean Energy Nation, and our guest, Martin Cheek, he is the co-author. He's worked as a journalist specializing in science and high-tech industry for more than two decades now, and he lives in California. And let's say, Martin, hi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Michael Ray. Thanks so much for having me as a guest on your show today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Martin, when we look at clean energy, is there even such a thing anymore?
Well, there's no such thing as a perfect energy source. We found that out as we wrote the book, and I think everybody knows that. But there are cleaner sources of energy, solar, wind. We're looking at also energy efficiency, the idea that less is more, and less you consume, the more you have to the more efficiently you consume your energy sources, the less you have to produce. So clean energy is a concept, and it's a concept that really is growing in our nation. And Jerry and I wrote a book that really focuses on clean energy as energy freedom for Americans.
You know, by the way, I'm on your side, and I really believe, Martin, that we do need to clean it up and we need clean energy. One of the problems, the biggest challenges we run into, well, I can't remember which one of the companies, and it happened recently, that we had a stimulus for, and they were making the solar panels, and they went bankrupt recently, and they ended up doing business in China, you know, building, et cetera, there. How do we, and I really believe that the idea, the concept of clean energy, I'm right there. How do you get over those challenges that get companies with the ability to move through and stay stable and in business to be able to accomplish this?
Well, it's interesting. Every economy at some level is an energy economy. And, I mean, you look back at the hunting and gathering stage and, you know, people using fire to cook their food. They need the energy sources for that. We're at a point where our economy is based on fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, and oil. But the problem is, well, we have a lot of problems with those fossil fuels, the environmental problems, the economic problems in terms of what we're really paying for fossil fuels. And I think what we need is really strong national policy to encourage, incentivize an American population to basically go toward cleaner energy sources and energy efficiency. So I think for now, I mean, it's difficult now for the transition to happen because, you know, we
we basically stacked the deck for fossil fuels. But once we stop doing that, and there's ways to achieve that, we can definitely go toward a cleaner energy society.
By the way, one of the things that we do have to look at what you're talking about, and I love what's going on with the book, because the book is the roadmap how to get there. But the key is if anybody thinks that this isn't going to happen with the cleaner energy, it may not happen in our lifetime. But the fossil fuels, that's not an unlimited source. There is going to be a time when there just isn't any more available.
That's right. And there was a man named King Hubbard back in the 1950s who saw that the production of oil, particularly oil, is going to peak, and he actually forecast it right in terms of Americans' production of oil in 1970. He predicted the world would have peak oil production in 2000. He missed that for a few reasons. Basically, better technology and energy or oil resources were found. But he's actually probably getting, or we're actually probably getting to world oil, peak oil probably in the next 10 years or so, according to the experts. And also coal. We have an abundance of coal, but in terms of the production of it, we're probably going to be hitting a coal peak in the next 20 or 30 years. So we need to really kind of plan for that and make sure our economy doesn't crash because we depend too much on the fossil fuels and haven't made the transition to a clean energy society.
Now, by the way, underneath this, I'm looking at this and we're talking about biofuels, aren't we?
Biofuels are part of the equation. There's a lot of interesting innovations and initiatives going on that right now.
Now, by the way, define a biofuel so the average person knows exactly what it is and we're all on the same page.
Well, consider what a biofuel is a life energy source. It came from some kind of life energy. In fact, fossil fuels at one point were biofuels. They were, from algae or from ancient trees that basically were covered over and were basically not decayed so much that, you lost your energy source. But today, a lot of people think of biofuels as ethanol and biodiesel, but there's many other forms of biofuel. One interesting thing that's happening now is algae. We're basically developing systems to grow algae and get the oil from that or energy oil from that. And also, there's energy gold in our garbage from our food processing plants and from our farms. There's development in interesting technologies to use anaerobic bacteria, to basically break down the carbohydrates in that garbage, or essentially garbage, and basically produce hydrogen and methane too, to fuel our cars and potentially in the future, and also to just burn in the power generation plants and produce electricity. So think of biofuels as a life energy source, and we have some interesting things happening. Also, prairie grass. A lot of people use corn. There's a strong corn lobby right now that's advocating corn for ethanol, but we can use prairie grass in the Midwest and basically have a more efficient system of producing ethanol using prairie grass instead of corn. So I see a lot of potential for biofuels, but we also have to realize it's just part of a bigger equation, and we need to incorporate a lot of other things in terms of our energy efficiency and also clean energy resources.
Now, by the way, Martin, do we have a world leader now? Is there someone leading it, or is that up to us?
I was really hopeful for when Barack Obama came into the office that he would be our clean energy president. I think he's burdened with a lot of political baggage that he can't achieve that yet. But the woman or the leader I really think is probably our global energy leader is Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. And she is really pushing Germany and Germans to develop solar and wind and energy efficiency type technologies. And I see her as a very positive role model, I think, for the other leaders of this world. Angela Merkel, basically. I hope someday she might win the Nobel Prize for Peace if she promotes Germany to become a clean energy nation.
Sure.
And I think she's somebody that, maybe Barack Obama should emulate.
Now, by the way, there is one area that you do discuss, and I think it's very interesting. I think it's fascinating as I look into this. National security has been a nationwide concern since 9/11 and remains so in the wake of Osama bin Laden's death. Question, how can a renewed commitment to renewable energy sources help America significantly become safer from foreign threats? That one, I cannot, in my heart of hearts, put that one together. I can't figure that one out.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things in terms of energy and national security. Obviously, you know, we are very dependent on foreign fuels. Most of our oil actually comes from Canada and Mexico, but we do get a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia and other, you know, OPEC nations. Unfortunately, those nations aren't as stable as, you know, maybe the North American nations. And also, our dependence on global, our dependence on oil from those nations basically puts us at jeopardy of basically being kind of an economic blackmail. If we do something they don't like, as we did back in the, 1973 with the oil embargo, they can reduce our supply and basically, you know, cause economic hardships for us. There's also, in terms of energy, the national grid situation. We have a national grid, our electric grid, the system that, you know, basically can, you know, brings electricity to our homes and businesses, is very old and not as stable as it should be. And I think one of the things we really need to do is make that something a priority for our nation to upgrade it. It's susceptible to attack. We can basically have a terrorist attack on our national grid in some different ways, either a cyber attack or also a nuclear explosion high up in the air could create magnetic waves that basically electromagnetic waves that would basically bring down the electric grid, which would devastate our nation, just not economically but socially. Another area is climate change from global warming. That's going to have a major impact on food supplies and water and droughts and blizzards, and that's going to have social impacts that, you know, we can't even imagine right now. And that would cause, you know, potential wars and the rise of dictators in certain areas of the world. And the major concern I have is our competition with China over foreign oil. We're basically competing with a rising nation in terms of China's industry. And they're basically putting the chess pieces in place for them to control the world's oil market. And at some point, we're not going to be able to compete with them. And there's a potential for an oil war basically with China in the future. So national security and energy are really intertwined. The Department of Defense really is concerned about these issues, and they have analysts and experts that are really kind of looking at you know, energy as, you know, an issue for, you know, our national security.
Sure, and one thing that runs right through the middle of all of it, Martin, it's the economy. There's going to be jobs. If you do this right, there'll be jobs.
Amen. I mean, we can produce millions of jobs in energy efficiency and energy production if we can just get our act together as a nation and move from the fossil fuel age to the clean energy age. It will be great for us to get off the roller coaster of our oil addiction. The price of barrels of oil, you know, really influences, you know, the stock market and also our economy and our jobs. It would be nice not to have to ship our dollars over to other countries for foreign oil. And I think also clean energy as a policy will be a great revenue generator for Americans. It would actually, in the long term, lower our taxes if we have more people working and less people, you know, dependent on, government, safety nets, and producing something. We definitely need to be more productive as a nation. We'll basically create more jobs, which will create more revenue, which will broaden the tax burden. So I think clean energy nation and the economy are really tied together. You know, if we can become a clean energy nation, we can really revitalize our economy.
Martin, what kind of a timeline do you think we're looking at here?
Well, you said it wouldn't happen in our lifetime, but I actually think there's a possibility it can. I'm 44 years old, and my lifetime, people said, "Oh, the Berlin Wall will never, fall. We'll always have communism." And something happened. Something magic happened in the Eastern Europe that basically the people decided, "I don't want this anymore. I want my freedom." And I think Americans and the world needs to kind of wake up to, in a similar fashion, and basically say, I don't want to be dependent on fossil fuels anymore. I want my energy freedom. And once we get to that point, that critical mass, I think, that really demands from the politicians that we want to become an energy-free society, in terms of our energy freedom and clean energy and energy efficiency, then you're going to see some major changes. I tell people I have a 2020 vision. If we can start now to really take an aggressive stand in terms of energy policy, we can by the year 2020 build a foundation for an energy free energy society, a clean energy society, and basically grow from that and give the future generations of Americans an opportunity for quality of life, higher quality of life, and national security, and good economic opportunities.
A quick question before we finish this up. We're running short of time now. What was it that caused you to get involved in this in the first place? What was it that sparked you to say, I need to delve into this, I need to research it, and I need to take a look at it?
Well, it's interesting. I helped Jerry McNerney in his campaign against a congressman named Richard Pombo back in 2006. Jerry gave a speech at a fundraiser at a person's home about energy, and he was very, very passionate about it. And at that point, I had never really considered energy issues, in terms of the broader spectrum, how it impacts our lives. And after that speech, Jerry and I met in the kitchen, and we started nibbling on the hors d'oeuvres that they had there. And I said, Jerry, if you win this election, do you want to write a book together about energy, about clean energy? And his eyes just lit up, and he said, yeah. And so I made a campaign promise to him that day, and we followed through, and it took 5 years for us to produce the book. I really grew while I was writing the book. I was looking at energy in terms of energy independence, which is basically getting off of foreign oil. But Jerry and I kind of came up with this idea of energy freedom, which is a much broader look at energy in terms of a clean energy nation, and that includes the national security issues, economy issues, the quality of life issues. And I think most important, the American spirit. I mean, we have done things in the past, heroic things as a nation, and we've kind of forgot how to do that. I call it the American amnesia. And I think sure. We need to basically get together as a nation and remember that we do things in a larger-than-life way, and we can make our nation a clean energy nation. And I tell people, for the sake of the future generations, let's make America a clean energy nation.
Martin, let me ask you this. We're out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
We have a website. It's called the address is www.cleanenergynationbook.com. And I really want to encourage your listeners to basically get an understanding of the energy issues that we face as a nation and really be proactive in contacting our leaders, the national and state and local leaders, and say we want to become a clean energy nation. And we need together, once we hit that critical mass, we can become a clean energy nation.
Wonderful. Hey, Martin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael Ray. I appreciate your time.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Take care.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. We'll stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Stacey Demoski with us. She is the author of Confessions of a Band Geek Mom. Before her days as a mom of two boys, Stacey is had patrons busting at the seams of laughter in California's comedy circuit, and she's since become an improv expert, a writer, a filmmaker, radio personality, and again, she's the author of Confessions of a Band Geek Mom. Hey, Stacey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, it's very interesting what life is like, and then all of a sudden you have a couple of boys, and life, it takes on a different look, doesn't it?
It sure does. Boy, I tell you, having kids is something that nobody can explain it to you until you have them. And by then it's too late.
It's gone and it's done. By the way, what part of California are you in?
Well, I'm not in California anymore. Now I live in Park City, Utah. But the part of California that I worked in before was Los Angeles all the way down to San Diego. I eventually moved to Encinitas because it was kind of between San Diego County and L.A.
What were some of the clubs you did?
Oh, well, the one that I kind of – what is every comedian kind of has their home. But I was in the Improv out of Santa Monica. I played there quite a bit. And then I also played the Comedy Store in La Jolla. It was kind of my home. But I also did the Comedy Store up on Sunset, the Ice House in Pasadena. I was all over the valley, all over L.A. proper, and all up and down Sunset.
Yeah. Now, by the way, the Sunset, and a lot of it changed. I grew up in that area 1,000 years ago. And, you know, La Cienega used to be, probably still is, was Restaurant Row, right?
Right.
Still? Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the literal translation of La Cienega is?
No, I don't. And, you know, I've always kind of wondered that. What is it? Do you know?
Yeah.
What is it?
The sewer.
No, really?
Yeah, it's the sewer.
It's too bad I didn't know that back then. I could have got a lot of comedy mileage out of that.
I bet you could have with all those restaurants on La Cienega. Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
Now, okay, back to school time. Okay, now with the kids, what caused you to take a look at life completely differently now with the kids?
Well, I had my kids a little bit later. I started in my mid-30s, and so I had this big, fabulous life before that, and it was a lot of fun. It was totally unrealistic, and when I got pregnant with my first son, I, of course, thought, oh, I can just go on and do this, and my kids are not going to impact this in any way, and it was like being hit by a train, of course. Life could not go on that way, and so I tried to keep that pace going on the comedy circuit and public speaking until my older son was about 15 months old. And then I just quit. I said, I can't do this anymore. And I sort of dropped out of sight and just kind of became a hermit. And in that time got pregnant again. But I needed a creative outlet. And so what I did was I started journaling. And that was also about the time that the internet and blogging was really getting going. And so I just started kind of getting it out there that way. And plus, I wrote jokes and did a lot of comedy writing for other comedians, I like doing that. I know some comics don't, but I really enjoy that. And so that was an outlet as well. And over the years, my oldest son is 16 now. I have this collection of work that I went back and was organizing because I got a new computer, and that'll make you do that. Sure. And I thought, wow, I have something here. You know, I have this chronicle of this life that the dichotomy was so different. You know, it went from A to Z at rapid pace. And I thought, I think people would be interested in this. So I took a lot of those blogs and essays and I expanded them into book chapter format. And before I knew it, I had Confessions of a Band Geek Mom.
Wow. It's got to be fun too. Music, obviously, the kids, they played in bands all over the place. What's it like being a, well, let's see, you'd have to be a roadie, wouldn't you?
I have turned into a roadie. I am schlepping horn cases and, you know, helping them pack. And it's funny because I'm kind of the side person now, which I totally love being to them. They are these musicians that are turns out they're very talented. They go to a private music school here in Utah. And as a result of being, it's called the Caleb Chapman Music School. And as a result of being in that school, they have played in jazz festivals all over the world. My older son just got back from a European tour where he played in Montreux and all over Switzerland, Italy. And this band that he's in, the Crescent Super Band, is been named by Downbeat Magazine as the top high school jazz band in the country.
No, that's great. There's no question about it. Do you have to ask them for their autographs, or do they still call you mom?
You know what? No matter how big they get or how big they think they get, I will always be able to cut them down to size. There's no way I'm going to get any back talk out of them.
No, they're all, and as a matter of fact, they're always going to be kids. I don't care if they're 90 years old. They will be your kids, the youngest and the oldest, and that's the end of it. You're always going to be mom.
Right. Well, the oldest now is he's 16 and he's 6'2", and I'm only 5'7". So I literally have to look up to talk to him, but you know, they listen, but they so far so good.
Yeah. Mom's got a step stool she'll get up on. I got it.
If I have to, I will stand on a step. Yep.
I was a really scrappy kid when I was growing up, and my mom was only 5 foot tall and never talked back to that woman. I could think, thinking about talking back to her, the hair on the back of my neck still curls.
Well, it's funny. There's a chapter in the book kind of like that called The Rhetorical Question. And as kids growing up, and then when you become a parent yourself, as kids, you always heard your parents say things like, do you want me to ground you? Do you want me to? And it would always be some stupid question that, of course, it's rhetorical. You would never answer that. But as a kid, you take that seriously. And I didn't really realize that until I became a parent and said, do you want me to ground you? Do you want me to take away your, you know, your PlayStation or whatever? And they looked me in the eye and seriously go, no. Like, wow, there's some power there.
Yeah, no, I got it loud and clear. But, of course, you know, I grew up in an era that it wasn't take away your PlayStation. It was, if you don't stop, we're going to throw you off the second-story building. I said, okay, I'll be good. But those were the days. It's a different world.
It is a different world. I do remember hearing from my parents, do you want me to spank you? Which I don't spank, but it's mainly because I just don't have the energy. I get them at different ways, you know. Irony is a good form of punishment.
Yeah. And by the way, there's no question about it. The world is completely different. The way we look at things completely different now. And I would bet any amount of money if you wrote the same book 15 years from now, it would be completely different.
Oh, probably. I always, when my kids say things like, oh, well, that's not fair, or why do you do that, or no one else makes their kids do it, why do you do that? I always say, you know what? You can tell your therapist in 25 years, but for now, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, so. I think that's, you know what, I think that's the difference. When I was a kid 100 years ago in the Los Angeles area, we didn't have therapists. You did what you did, and if you did something, you faced the consequence, and we all got brought up okay. Do I have a problem with the way it's going on today? No, that's the culture. You know, and I will never change, and thank goodness I don't have kids because I would end up in jail, I'm sure I would.
Well, I would have thought that about myself, but it just, I don't know, like I said, it's on-the-job training. I cannot believe when they let you take that little baby home and there's no user manual, there's no nothing. They just kind of send you on your way and you get home and you and your spouse look at each other and say, what the heck did we do?
Yeah, no, I hear you loud and clear. Let me ask you this. I pick this book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. Stacey, what do I get out of it? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I didn't have before I read the book? What's the core?
What's my spark? The core of it is, and it's really resonant with not just people with kids, but with anybody, is you cannot do it all. I grew up in an era where, you know, I am woman, hear me roar. And I'm speaking for men and women, but being a woman, I grew up in, my mom was in the women's movement. And, you know, I was in high school, graduated in the late 70s. I was right in the core of it. And they made you believe that you could do it all. And you know what? You can't. Something's got to give. And you will go crazy trying if you don't come to your senses and quit early on. And so what this book does is it shows that no parent is perfect, certainly not me. I make a lot of mistakes and I proudly put them in print and hope that everybody can get a chuckle out of them, including my kids maybe in, you know, 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah.
But I really do believe that as people, we have to cut ourselves slack and say, you know what? I don't think I can do this, or maybe I should reevaluate my goals and take a right turn here. And there's no failure in that. It's just, I think that's on the contrary. You kind of come to a wisdom that allows you the freedom to change direction. And so that's exactly what I did. I had a lucrative career and I ended up changing direction. I still have friends in California that look at me and think, oh, you poor thing. Wow, yeah. That didn't turn out too well for you, did it? And I beg to differ. It turned out great.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's called purpose change, value change.
Okay. That sounds good to me.
But isn't that it? You know, your purpose changed. So the values changed and the way you thought about things changed. And what may be absolutely great for you is not going to be that good for them, and let them have their life and enjoy yourself.
Well, we can take that even one step further and say what was good for you at 25 may not be good for you at 35 or 45 or 55. And so if you are one of those few people who are lucky enough to say, I wanted to be a dentist ever since I was 5. And so you become a dentist and you love that for the next 30 years. Great. Good for you. But most people don't do that. Most people change and they're not the same person they were 10 years ago, certainly not 20 or 30 years ago. And so if you hold on to the same goals and values you had then just because you think you stubbornly should, then you're in for a big world of hurt.
No, and sometimes you have to forecast and look ahead. I was in the fifth grade, and the material was real easy for me. They would actually skip me a grade, but they couldn't keep me quiet. So they kept me where I was, and I ended up to be a talk show host for almost 30 years.
See, now you're paid to talk, and they were trying to shut you up back then.
Absolutely. I stayed back a grade, but I was happy about it. You know, I've got something here that the Radio Susie sitting across the desk from me, she, every time it comes up with the I Am Woman and the Helen Reddy stuff, and I think it's wonderful, so don't hear me shooting it down. But most people say, I don't get it. You know, women have always had a chance and so on and so forth. Her late husband had some things, and she stored some things over at my place, and this book fell out of one of the boxes. I swear it's in front of me now, okay? And it's called The Milk and Ice Cream Dairy and Drivers and Dairy Employers Union Local 225. It's the Dairy and Ice Cream Union Agreement from 1964 to 1967. On page 77, which I have marked, it's Article 15, it says female. The employer shall not employ female help on any identical operation as now performed or hereto performed by male help. So it was out there.
It definitely was out there.
Yeah, I know. And when she gives me trouble, I pull the book out and I say, page 77, don't bother me.
Yeah, no, well.
It was out there, yes.
It definitely was. Well, in a lot of ways back then, and I'm not advocating it because I kind of like the direction things have gone for women. But in a lot of ways, it was easier because the roles back then were so defined. Some people weren't happy with them, and that was the problem, you know, the whole Sylvia Plath Bell Jar kind of existence. But you knew what your roles were, and if you were lucky enough to fit in that role, life was pretty easy because you came pre-pressed knowing what was expected of you. Yeah. And you led all the way up to that from day one. And then you were let loose and expected to, if you're a woman, you know, keep a house and a family and do all these great things. It just was a problem if you didn't fit into that mold.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of it started, you know, after the 40s, you know, after the war, you know, there were so many moms that lost their kids and there was they worked in the factories and they took on the men's jobs and so on and so forth. In the 50s, which I'm a product of growing up in the 50s. I was born in the 40s, but I actually grew up in the 50s. And what happened was a lot of the moms said, we're staying home, we're going to take care of our families. And from 1950 to, let's say, 1960, everything was family-oriented. Now, the 60s hit, and we know what happened from there, and then things turned the way they turned, whatever it was, good, bad, or indifferent. But it was a cultural change that caused it. And you're absolutely right. Everybody knew their roles in that period of time. It doesn't work that way anymore, and it's never going to go back that way.
No, I think it even goes beyond a cultural change. I think it was a whole paradigm shift because we've never gone back. I mean, it changed for good. It took a turn and it's morphed in many ways since then. But I can't even imagine what could happen in the world to go back to, pre-60s family.
It's not going to happen. You know, there are many things that pre-60s family was good because it was a bonding there. There was a little bit of a different story. But I really believe that you have to define, not so much a role, but what a man is, what a woman is, so on and so forth. It was like, I never cared for Hillary Clinton. It was something, I didn't like her. I would have never voted for her. But had she become president, she would have become she would have become my president, because the moment she would have become president, she wouldn't have been a woman anymore. She wouldn't have been black. She wouldn't have been white. She wouldn't have been orange. She wouldn't have been anything. She would have been the most powerful person in the entire world. And I think that in and of itself is what people have to get beyond. It's, you move into a position or whatever. You're the position. And what you brought with you to create that position was everything you've ever been through in your life.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely the case. And you have to get on board with that, or you're just going to be left behind.
Sure. No question. With the women's movement, when it came to feminism, that's what I want to say. If feminism means the opportunity of a woman to get anything she wants anywhere, anytime, anyhow, I'm all for it. I'm a feminist. All right. But if it means the subjugation of man to get there, no, I'm against it. See, I think that's where the problem lies.
No, it has to be equal along the whole way. It can't be one side overtakes another.
No.
So, a funny, this reminds me of a funny story that I'd want to write about in the next book. And my older son, a couple of years ago, they were studying the Constitution, all the amendments. And he found out in history that women were not allowed to vote until 1920. And he could not even wrap his head around that because his grandparents were born before 1920. And so it was funny because he couldn't understand why anybody wouldn't let a woman vote.
Yeah.
Thought that was like an alien concept. And he said all the other kids in the class, too, were just looking at each other and kind of, especially the girls, they were just looking at each other with these furrowed brows, thinking that the teacher made that all up.
No, and by the way, when it comes down to it, with the vote, the vote was symbolic of something. There was a time that, and in other countries now, women are property. They're not human beings. They're not, I don't have to go through it. You know the story.
Yeah.
And until the time came, women weren't citizens. They weren't, they didn't have that stability and that place in the world that men had. The right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the way it was. That's not the way it is today. But that's really what it was. It's an indicator of that, you got a driver's license, you can vote, you can do all the stuff. That means that you're a 100% citizen now, and you have all the rights and privileges of anybody else in the country.
Mm-hmm. But going back to that original question, that doesn't mean you can do it all. You got to kind of pick and choose and make choices. It's almost like they give you so many options today, men or women, that you can do fun things like go on the road and be a comedian and make people laugh and live this wonderful traveling life. But then if you want to raise kids the way the way I wanted to raise them, I couldn't be the parent I wanted to be and continue with the job I had.
Got it loud and clear. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. I spent many years as an entertainer traveling just like you did. And one of the best places that I ever played, I'm going to one-upmanship. Are you ready for this?
I'll bet
you've never been at this place, okay? I played Alice's Champagne Palace in Homer, Alaska.
Oh, no, you got me there. No.
Let me tell you what, Stacey, it looked exactly the way it sounds. And with that, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. My website actually the best place to go is the book's Facebook page, because the website is under construction right now. So it's on Facebook. It's just search on Confessions of a Band Geek Mom.
Wonderful. Hey, Stacey, thank you so much for joining us. I've had fun with the interview.
I really appreciate you having me on, Michael, and it was fun for me too.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Thanks a lot. So strange.
Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. Music that used to seem hollow now seems to fit in your rain. Today is the now and the never. Damned if what you're feeling is in change. It's fun to wander along a yesterday road, trying so hard to retain all of the wondrous and beautiful times that never can happen again. So get yourself up off your past, friend. There's so much.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Tom Paine coming up next.
Tomorrow sits right next to never. Damned if what you're feeling is in change.
Tom Paine with us. He's the author of The Template of Times, Our Destiny Decoded. He's the president of Essential Growth Solutions, LLC. Holds a BA in psychology and English. He served in the Airborne Ranger Qualified Infantry Officer before entering sales and marketing. 8 years of research led to his book, The Template of Time, Our Destiny Decoded, and his website, www.thetemplateoftime.com, which is updated with new predictions on a regular basis. Hey, Tom, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael, glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You are what's called a futurist. Now, define a futurist for the average person out there so they can get a grip on it and get their arms around it.
Well, I suppose a futurist is the only way to describe what it is that this book does, because basically futurists try to profile and guess at what the future will be. And there's futurism that occurs in so many different fields, from economics. I mean, Chairman Ben Bernanke is trying to forecast what the next quarter's GDP is going to be, what the next year's GDP is going to be. So that's a futuristic activity. Weather people, meteorologists, they're trying to forecast and model what the next day's weather is going to be, and so forth and so on.
Okay, so basically then what you're looking at, based on your research, and some of the things, obviously, that you called, you predicted Hosni Mubarak's ouster would be around 2010. It happened in 2011, but he's out. You forecasted the change of leadership in Yemen in 2014, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, et cetera, which looks like that's going to happen. But what is it that we're looking at that could really have an impact on this world today, this globe? What do you see that's coming up?
I think one of the, it comes all the time from this region, but the Middle East is a tinderbox. And one of the predictions that the book makes is that Israel will be at war with Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Egypt sometime in the next year or two. And that's going to be a very destabilizing event. Additionally, it's predicting that Israel, and possibly with the help of the United States, that's not as clear, but Israel will be bombing the nuclear facilities in Iran. And if that takes place, as I believe it will, in the next year or two, then you're going to have a very destabilized situation with respect to oil. And that will affect the global economy, as it has done several times before this.
So realistically, not necessarily what goes on here in this country in and of itself, but based on what goes on globally, is going to have the impact on this country, probably a worse economic impact than we are looking at with our forecast of being in debt.
I believe that to be the case. Now, I'm not all gloom and doom, because I do think that the United States will emerge from this stronger. It has a way of doing it, and the forecast shows this as well. So it's not a pessimistic view of history, but several of the events of history are pointing to some nasty and ugly outcomes. And I think that one of the things that I try to do in this work is give the reader some idea of where we're headed. Because if you're just seeing all this collapsing about your ears and the craziness of world history, you think it's all chaotic. But it's not. It's following a very closely patterned model of time.
So what we're saying here, that history is cyclical. If we go back and we can look, we can, quote unquote, forecast what's going to happen to us?
To a degree, it's a very simple model, and I can explain it very simply. You have historical movements begin. Well, about 32 years later, they move in a new direction, and about 4 years after that, the new direction achieves its culmination. It grows, and then it bears fruit. And I'll give you an example on the prediction about Israel and how I came up with it. Around the year 1974, there were all sorts of historical movements. One of them was the Yom Kippur War in 1973. In that war, Israel was invaded by Egypt and Syria. Okay, so about 32 years later, this is supposed to move in a new direction around the year 2006. Well, what happened in 2006? Things changed dramatically. Israel became the invader. They invaded Lebanon to take on Hezbollah. In 2007, they invaded Syrian airspace to bomb what many believe to be their nuclear facility. And in 2008, they invaded Gaza to take on Hamas. Well, these new directions are small, and they grow, and then they achieve a culmination around 4 years later. So it points to the outbreak of war around the year 2010, which would be 2011, 2012, between these countries. And that's how the template works. It's cyclical and to some degree, but it's really more of a linear progression with these cycles inside of this line of time.
By the way, Tom, what do you see for us? And when I say what do you see for us, the economy here, do you think we will get back to the basis of what this country is supposed to be about, or do you see us so rapidly changing that we're going to get swallowed up globally?
No, I think that the United States will continue to be a dominant power militarily and economically for at least another 20 or 30 years. And there are many strong reasons for it, but we will also go through a tougher economic time than the one we're going through now. If you recall, there were two oil shocks delivered, and one was in 1973, the Arab oil embargo. Well, according to this template, around 36 years later, this movement in history achieves its culmination. There was another oil shock around 1979 when Iran was taken over by the Ayatollah Khomeini. And that pattern of time also converges on the year 2010. So I'm expecting that there will be some disruption of the oil supply, and that's going to hurt the economy for the short term. But that said, after that oil shock of 79, you then had the Reagan Revolution and years of prosperity, and Bill Clinton played a role in that prosperity too. So it's not, sure, this isn't a Republican commercial, but I think there's going to be a shock to our economic system, an additional shock, followed by years of prosperity.
Now, by the way, do you think that we will, cyclically, does it show anything about, you know, we were concerned about oil, what happens globally can affect us, et cetera, and our stock markets. But what about all of those trillions of gallons of untapped oil that we have here in this country? Are you thinking we're going to touch any of this?
You know, that's a very good question. I haven't looked into it, but that's one that I'll have to look into. A lot of times readers who contact me send me in directions to look at different things. One of them was, for example, the Arab Spring. When that thing erupted, they said, well, what do you think is going to happen to all these different nations? And so I just started updating it, and I posted it on the website. But that's another good area to explore, because we do have great untapped potential, and I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, and when I say whatever reason, that's exactly what it is. Whatever reason, we haven't been able to touch on that. The other thing that you might look into also is, you know, we were a country that produced. We weren't a consuming country. We were a producing country. We've become consumers from other countries all over the world. So another thing to look at: are we going to start production again? Are we going to get back to manufacturing? Are we going to get back to that kind of income coming in?
That's a good question. I think that our economy is fundamentally changed. We are manufacturing some, but it's more of a service, software, cyberspace type of economy. And I hope that we don't lose all of our manufacturing jobs, because it's a key to long-term stability and self-sufficiency.
No question about it. Okay. Can you forecast the kind of the kind of administration that we'll end up with. And I don't mean it's going to be this one, that one, or whatever. But are we going to have a stronger administration? We need some type of leadership, that which doesn't seem to be happening right now. And no matter how big we are, how strong we are, we need somebody to follow. And that's really the way it, that's the way it breaks down.
Well, there are these patterns in time, and I call them fractals. It's but anyway, just to make it simple, they have years of initiation, you know, where a movement begins. And so one of them occurred in 1984, another occurred in 1994, and the third occurs in 2010. And if you look around 1984, that was the time of the Reagan Revolution, when it was really starting to kick into gear and growth was starting to occur. 1994, you had the prosperity of the Clinton years. I think that around 2012, we will have we will elect someone who will be a very pro-business, pro-growth president, who will help bring us back to prosperity, and probably bring us back to prosperity after an oil shock has occurred that he will inherit, or she will inherit.
Yeah, he or she, whichever. I'm looking at some very interesting people there, and I really do see some very drastic changes that'll go on in 2012. I've been around this planet for a lot of years now, and I've seen some ups, I've seen some downs, and it seems that every time we stray from quote unquote who we are, the problems begin.
Yeah, and I would think that one of the things that we do a real good job of in the United States is build up our enemies or our competitors to a level where we think that they're so much stronger than we are. We did it with the Soviet Union. We did it with Japan. And both of those countries are something of basket cases economically. And we're doing it to some degree with China. But China, I believe, is experiencing its own bubble, which when that bursts, they're not going to seem as almighty as they do right now.
No, and I think when it does burst, the one thing that we have that they don't have, we have stability. We have a background in being capitalist with the economy that we've had. They don't have it. This is brand new to them. So there's nothing to fall back on.
Well, another thing that the template projects is the outbreak of democracy in China. They're going to experience levels of unrest and change that are going to be seem destabilizing, but ultimately will be strengthening to them.
Now, by the way, you know, I think it would be a great thing, and we have Radio Susie contact you, if we can get you on once a month and follow through with this, because I think if we really take a look at this and as things come to fruition and they happen, I think it would be a good thing to, if nothing else, get people thinking about this and taking a look at who we are, what we are, and why we are, because cyclically, it does nothing more than prove out who we are. And it's not the what we are, it's the who we are.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something that a lot of people aren't looking at very strongly, and that is Europe. We tend to think of Europe as a basket case of a bunch of fiscally inept countries that cling to a monetary union, the euro, but don't have any collective political will and so forth and so on. Well, the template strongly suggests that Europe is going to get fiscal union, they're going to get political union, and they're going to become a military superpower with global ambitions. So I think that Europe is actually going to become the main event in many ways. The United States is a protected nation for a bunch of reasons. One of them is the oceans that separate us and the huge advantage we have in the Navy, which will take dozens of years for anybody to try to match. But Europe will become a military superpower. That's strongly suggested by the template. Additionally, Europe will experience a massive outbreak of terrorism, which could be something that would help lead to this sort of emergency mindset that requires some political centralization.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can, by the way, I can see that loud and clear. Tom, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. You can find me at the templateoftime.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tom Payne, thank you so much for being here. Radio Susie's going to connect with you. I think this would be great to keep following through. And thank you so much
great.
For being here tonight.
Thank you.
The curtain's fallen, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter.